Yes, and welcome to the EIQ Nutrition Podcast. How are you, Amelia?
I'm great. How are you?
I am also great.
Great. Anything new, exciting, wild, like, to share?
I'm trying to think. I was doing some reading this week. Now I can't remember exactly what I was reading up on, which obviously means it was extremely exciting.
Sometimes it's not wildly exciting, but it's important because it confirms things that you already knew. And still important to know.
I can't remember what it was though, so yeah, what about you? Have you read
I don't
anything?
remember. I read a few things recently. One thing I read today, I didn't read the full paper, but I was intrigued by the title. The title, "It Helps to Be Funny or Compassionate: An Exploration of User Experiences and Evaluation of Social Media Micro Intervention Designs for Protecting Body Image." And so the idea was looking at the idea of the studies. There are a couple of different studies put into one article, looking at how we can use social media in a positive way to support body image compared to obviously the traditional image focused. Like, we know Instagram, for example, is the worst social media platform for body image out of all of the social media platforms. And
Why?
so I think it's because it's predominantly filled with selfies and bodies, whereas like TikTok's much more like funny and like it's less about appearance, and then Facebook is much more like maybe slightly different age as well, but it's much more like people saying things and connecting with people they know, like
Selling rubbish out of the front room.
exactly, MLMs. So I think Instagram is just very appearance
Yeah, I
focused.
guess that's true. Yeah.
So they were looking at different digital messages, and I'm gonna just read out a couple of interesting bits, like the main part. So they were basically looking at users, so it's all qualitative, but they were looking at Instagram users' feelings and experiences of body image online. And when they were browsing, they were looking at browsing behaviors and preferences when using Instagram. And then they looked at different types of micro interventions. So the types of micro interventions were things like appearance-related self-compassion. Wait, hold on. They looked at different types of messaging, right? So they were either compassion-focused, humorous, or factual, right? Compassion-focused, humorous, or factual posts, basically. Appearance-related self-compassion and humor-themed messages were rated as being significantly more likely to be read as being more emotionally positive and having greater perceived effectiveness for protecting body image than factual messages or neutral images. Such messages were perceived to work by influencing beliefs about appearance ideals and appearance-based comparison, which is not sure. Of course, it's not surprising in any way, but I like it because it's like, stop putting out your factual body image stuff. I lose count of how many times obviously I've said this, and obviously we, like, especially I will do some kind of more I suppose intellectual post stuff because I'm also marketing to EIQ personal trainers, right? So it's slightly different. But if you are a coach supporting people's body image, stop putting out like, here's a fact about body image here. Be funny, be compassionate. Remember what compassion is. And if you're thinking about it like this, it's like, okay, well, do this because you want to have a positive impact, but also if it's having more positive emotional responses, that's probably going to help with your connection to people. And they're more likely to be read, which obviously helps with your connection to people and your impact on people. We're not just saying this for shits and giggles, but I like this study because it's complete confirmation bias. And it's obviously one study, it's qualitative, it's not groundbreaking. But it did make me laugh because it was like the title was like, be funny and be compassionate. And like, great, life lesson right there.
You can blend all three, which I think is the best kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
If you're funny, compassionate, and then you're like, at the end, oh, and here's a study to show it if you want to read up on the I don't know, five best principles to blah blah blah, whatever. You can kind of
Yeah.
show all three, and I think the posts that do the best or the Instagram accounts that do the best, they do that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And like, but it's a difference between having a reel where you're having fun and then being like, for example, this study saw this, like I'm not just making this up. Da, 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 da. Like there's that kind of reel, or there's like a here's a screenshot of an article, here's what it found. They had two groups. Da, da, da. Like not many people, especially on the IQ, will present things in that way, but the more you become educated because you're doing EIQ, because you're an EIQ grad, the more you learn, the more likely you are to fall into that without you even realizing that you're doing it. So do a little review of your content and look at like realistically how you're presenting stuff. I mean, ultimately, of course, you're focused on solving problems, and intellectual facts are not necessarily solving people's problems anyway, so you shouldn't be doing it anyway. But I thought it was quite a nice study.
No, babe, you want to have clients that don't have problems.
Oh
We spoke
yeah,
about that
sorry.
last week. Yeah, no, they're much easier.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So you
They
could cure all
pay
the
you
problems.
to do nothing because they don't have any problems for you to help with. Remember?
Correct.
Yeah.
How did I forget that excellent piece of mentoring advice from last week? How? How? Should have been etched in my brain. The other thing I was reading was about GLP-1s and or GLP, like I think they're talking about, I don't think they're talking about the same pick. I don't know if I still got it up because it was the other day. Let's have a little
Was it
look.
in pregnancy?
No, but that's interesting. It was in binge eating disorder. And the reason I kind of, so I've spoken to Roz about this, and we've had a few ETPHD chats about this because, you know, we do get a lot of people working with us who have been prescribed them from their doctor. And of course Roz works in the eating disorder realm. So we've had conversations about it, and I was aware that this existed, but the evidence is really pretty positive when it comes to binge eating disorder and these drugs. And the reason why I think it's a little bit extra interesting is because the people who are against these drugs, and I'm talking about in specific clinical situations, I'm not talking about, you know, Khloe Kardashian taking Ozempic. Like I am talking about the prescription requirements, you know, the right use of these drugs. The people that are against this proper use of these drugs, right? Because they're like, it doesn't teach you anything. It doesn't tackle the underlying things. And it's like, I agree, right? So it has to come alongside behavior change support, etc. Like I fully agree with that. But when you take something like binge eating disorder, which is not just a hunger thing, it's not like people are binge eating because they're hungry solely that. There are myriad contributors, right, to binge eating disorder. And yet in these people, we still see potential positive impacts of these weight supporting drugs. And it kind of, it's like you have the opinion of people who automatically want to hate it because it's diet culture. It's not. But you have the opinion, it's like the same opinions as 95% of diets fail. And then you have the research, it's like, well, actually, like, this is what it is. And it's like, again, it just highlights like people just want to hate on. Yes, I hate diet culture, but they want to hate on anything that they can remotely bash into that box of diet culture. And it's like, it's not diet culture. They're pretty supportive for a lot of people. Again, we want them to be supported in the right way and with the behavior change alongside of it. And it's just like any other drug, if you stop taking it, they'll stop working. Yes, we know all of this stuff, but you know, most people with binge eating disorder are in an overweight or obese bodies. So that was interesting.
So now, I mean, I can see why it works. I know that there's, like you say, there's so many reasons that someone might binge eat, but one of them might be hunger or what they're getting from eating at that much. And even if actually it's working as like negative reinforcement of like, okay, well, when you try and overeat on this, you feel awful. So that is kind of like what's happened with a lot of people who have binge eating tendencies is it's kind of become, well, definitely a coping mechanism, but also within that, like a bit of a habitual coping mechanism of like every time I feel like this, then I overeat or then I binge or whatever it is. Now, if that doesn't become soothing anymore because actually it's so uncomfortable to do that, then it's kind of teaching you a new, you're going to stop doing that behavior because it's not enjoyable anymore. And then you're going to learn a different behavior. Now, when you stop taking that drug, you might not necessarily go back to doing that because you've broken that habit loop. Some people might. But I certainly don't think you could be like, as soon as you stop taking the drug, then you'll just go back to exactly the way you were before. So many people that I know that have either been on Ozempic or have had like gastric bands or something have then completely changed their life as well And because they lost the weight, now they go to the gym as well. And it's like they're almost, in terms of their habits, they're like a completely different person. Even if you took away like the drug or you like reversed the surgery or something, they might put on some weight, but I don't think they'd revert and like straight away back to these other behaviors. Like from just thinking about like their lifestyle is just so different now that, yeah, I don't think they would regress. Now, I'm sure some people do, and we know that some people do, but that's interesting. The other thing I read this week, and I haven't looked into the research on this yet, but apparently Ozempic is interfering potentially with birth control.
I had heard that, but I've not seen any research on it.
Now, I don't know. It'd be interesting to know like whether it's a direct like drug interference or whether it's that people are losing weight and thus becoming more fertile, or whether it's that they're having more sex because they like their bodies more, or whether it's a bit of all of it.
I think it's Big Pharma in bed with the Republicans in America who are pro-life, anti-women, and they're like, do you know what? This is a great way to start getting them pregnant and banning them from having abortions. Then we'll increase the population the way that we want and control women's bodies. That's what I think it is.
Oh, that's definitely right. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm surprised that wasn't the thing that you read.
Yeah.
It is interesting, though. Very interesting. I think it's an interesting discussion because I saw you probably won't know who this is, but she's an actress. She's called Busy Phillips, right? And she's an American actress and she's quite famous. And she was getting interviewed and they were saying to her, what do you think about Ozempic? And she was like, I don't give an app like a flying fuck about Ozempic. She was like, men have been taking HGH and God knows what for years and years and years to fit into their like roles in the movies, and now women are taking something to fit into their roles in the movies, and we're demonizing them. She was like, we literally are doing exactly what we've been told to do along, which is get smaller, and we're doing it, and you're still telling us that we shouldn't be doing it because we're using these things. And there was a lot of what she said I didn't agree with, but it was interesting, and I found myself agreeing with her more than I thought I would. And I looked at some of the comments on the video, and people were like, oh, people were slaying her, kind of cancel-y type. And I was like, oh, I kind of agree with some of what she was saying. But it was interesting because there's like people are just bracking it all together. Like Ozempic is like what Oprah took and X, Y, and Z. And it's like, yeah, but that's not like you could say the same about anything in the wrong situation, it's probably not the right thing to do. But in the right situation, it could be really helpful. But again, people that are just immediately want to bash it are like, nope. But
Yeah, I
I thought
agree.
that was.
I do think that like there is like it is worrying the amount of celebrities that are taking it and then it now becoming like the norm and then everyone like I don't know wanting to take it. Like I think that is quite worrying. 'Cause, and you're right, like in the right population, I think it's an amazing drug, potentially life-saving. I mean, not even potentially, like it is life-saving, but I just worry about like, you know, would you want your teenage girl taking that? Like, but seeing that all the
Yeah.
celebrities are taking it, like that's just a really dangerous message to be putting across.
Yeah,
Especially
and it's
if people are now getting pregnant. Like, then the 16-year-old taking Ozempic and getting pregnant, like.
yeah, because there is the wider societal problem of we're going back to what we're saying is thinner is better, thinner is better, thinner is better, and now it's everywhere, and we're going back to that thin ideal that and that is going to be pervasive, and the more we're reducing this the body size of the norm of like the culturally celebrated body, there's a lot to be said for Kardashians, but like they did a lot for like starting to normalize slightly different shapes, and we have come quite far with all of this stuff, and the more those types of people, famous people, etc., become all tiny, then we're saying okay, that's where we want to be again. So there's like yeah.
I
It's
think it will
interesting.
be like it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next 5, 10 years. Because there's so much knock-on effect to like everything. You know, like one, it might be like, oh, good, people are taking this drug and they're eating less. But then okay, well, what does that mean for restaurant culture or eating out, or, you know, are people going to be drinking as much or eating as much, or like, and how does that impact people, and what does that mean for society, and will we go out for as many, like, I don't know, there's just so many. And hey, maybe there'll be positives, maybe it'll be like, you know, the norm is to go out on a Friday night for a meal, but maybe now people go and play mini golf all the time. But there's more like activities or something.
Dating with Emma.
But yeah, it would just be interesting.
Yeah, agree. Okay, stones. Oh, I was on them, but of course, it's come off. Just don't mind me having a wee scroll. BRB.
Oh my god, no.
No, we're fine.
Okay.
Okay. Lucy's question. Hi, legends. Hope you are good. I have a client losing weight at the moment, and she tends to eat two big meals a day and nothing else. They are 80% of the time well-balanced with protein, veggies, and starchy carbs. My worry is, will she maintain this beyond fat loss, and is she possibly missing out on nutrients? For example, she doesn't eat much fruit. As a result, she's happy with the approach, but I just wanted to hear your thoughts on this.
I think if she's genuinely happy, she's not over-restricting, she understands why it's working, that it's a calorie deficit, that she has the flexibility to create that deficit in another way, that she's getting enough. I wouldn't worry so much if she doesn't eat that much fruit, as long as she's getting in enough veg and variety there. But you could always be like, okay, well, let's add in even like one piece of fruit as well as the two meals. Yeah, like... I wouldn't have a massive issue with it. I just want to have like open communication that like there isn't any negatives going on there, and that if, I don't know, she was going away with family, she wouldn't feel like she couldn't eat with them or something. Aside from that, I'm like, yeah, if you want to create a deficit that way, fine.
I agree on the whole. I think times like when she's with family or there's a meal out or something will be a nice opportunity for you to open up discussion and say, oh, this is an opportunity for you to, you know, be mindful. Maybe you'll have more meals that day, or, you know, snacks, whatever that looks like. And this is a great opportunity to show that you can do it in a different way and feel okay about it, and reframing it for her if there is any stress. But yeah, I kind of agree. I think long term, I wouldn't say this is ideal long term for health, to be honest. Like, I don't mean for a fat loss period of time, but I don't personally feel like two meals a day with no snacks. Depends what's in them, because realistically, someone's meal could be really varied versus like someone else's two meals could be very similar. So you can't make that assumption. But I would say potentially someone on who was eating at maintenance-ish, two meals a day, I would question if they're getting things like enough polyunsaturated fats, enough variety in that every for a long term. I probably wouldn't think that would, again, I'm not saying blanket, but I would say I'd be mindful of a long term. But for a fat loss diet, fat loss phase, I think that's fine.
So I was thinking about variety this week. And it's quite interesting that like a lot of the research around variety and gut microbiome and having 30 different plant-based foods and stuff, like, it's all observational data, right? It's quite hard to tell whether it's that or whether that just because they eat more fruit and veg, that they have like a more diverse gut microbiome, or, you know, whatever health outcomes that you're looking for. There's no like solid, now I think from, if you're just kind of being like, oh, it kind of makes a lot of sense to try and get a varied fruit. But like, I'm not saying don't vary your diet, but I do wonder how important that is. And when you think about how we've eaten as humans for however long, probably didn't have a very varied diet. Now, that's not to say that that was optimal, right? Like, I don't really like the whole like paleo people ate like this, so we should too. It's like, yeah, you could survive eating like that. It doesn't mean that that's the best diet, right? And I still don't think we know what the quote unquote best diet is. But I also don't think there's that much like hard, strong evidence that you should necessarily have a very diverse diet. And if you think about eating seasonally, like, we probably just ate parsnips when they were in season, for like months, and then we probably just ate whatever else was in season for that period of time. Like, you wouldn't be having like the same mixture of food that you can have now. And again, that might be a benefit, but I don't know if it's like, I just think it's interesting to question like the common narratives that we all just kind of like, well, yeah, more variety is better.
I half agree with you. I think what you're saying, like that stuff, I think it came from a couple of focused, quote unquote, original, like gut health people, that narrative and some pieces of research that then everyone kind of jumped on. And I totally agree with that. Like, I think some of it's there, but I totally agree with that. I never really agree with going back to like, oh, in the olden times they did this, so that probably makes sense now.
No, I don't agree with that either. Like, I think I made that point, but I still think, yeah, I like, we have evolved to be able to eat. And like, there are even like centenarian groups. Is that the right word?
I don't know, because I was just thinking, what a great word that you've just come up with. So I don't know, but it's great.
Anyway, like people that live over 100, like these blue zones.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of them eat very like samey diets.
Yeah.
And they don't have much variety in them. And then there's like a group of like Inuit somewhere that like just eat like 90% fat and they live to however long. Now, you can't say that if they had a varied diet, they wouldn't be living even longer. And it's not actually the fact that they're so active, and maybe it's the cold exposure and the amount of brown fat they have and how metabolically active they are, and they're all these things. And it's like, despite the fact that they eat a 90% fat diet, they still live a very long time. You don't know that, right? Like, and a lot of this research is like, you know, we look at what these people do and I'm like, oh, well, maybe we should do that. But I was like, well, could they be even healthier if they had varied diet? Like, maybe, we don't know. But we also don't necessarily know that having a varied diet is better.
Yeah, agree. It is centenarian.
Oh, great, well, there we go.
Great word. Great word.
Oh, do you know what else I read but couldn't find the study for? And I really want to find it. I don't know if it was actually just a journalist that wrote this, but he basically sent poo samples to like 5 different, like essentially Zoe Dyer-esque type things, right?
I'm just laughing about the person that we know that got sent poo in the post from his ex.
Yeah, that was a good time.
Sorry, continue.
Yeah. I love that that just lives on. Anyway, this person sent like obviously the same poo sample to different places and got completely different readings back, unsurprising. And then sent again his same sample to the same place numerous times with completely different results, right? And this is just like a real great example of like, don't pay to send your poo to Tim Spector, because it's not even consistently inaccurate. Like, it is literally just seems like it's just fucking random what you get back.
I wonder how long it's going to be before a man with a podcast starts talking about poo transplants, because you've heard
this, no one done that before, because
there is some that, yeah, there,
well,
is,
do you know what we had? Oh, this is so funny. I don't know, I'll need to find it, right? On Fitness Unfiltered once, I cannot remember where this woman came from, and I have a horrible feeling that I think I suggested her, because I think I heard her on something else. I thought she was really good, but I could see Mike's face the whole way through, like, we can't put this out. Maybe we actually didn't. Anyway, she was talking about how, like, she'd had these, like, gut problems, and then she got these, like, legitimate, like, poo transplants, and by a doctor and whatever, and this was over in Australia, and she's like, but it cost me thousands and thousands of dollars. So then what I started doing is just making my own, right? Getting her friend's poo, putting it in capsules and eating it. And Mike was like, that's so dangerous, you can't do that. But she's like, I couldn't afford to like do the proper procedure thing, right? But anyway, yeah, no, I don't know why that's not, that was years and years and years ago.
Oh my god.
I know my friend, he runs Entrobiotics or whatever. They're like a legit company that like freeze poo, do transplants. Normally it's for the, what is the condition that is actually like helped by that. There is one, I can't,
I'm not sure. I don't know where I was looking at the, what the specific thing I was looking at. And I'm just having a quick.
But I know people got really excited about the research on mice where they put an obese mouse's poo into a lean mouse and it became obese, and then swapped it over and it became lean. And you're like, oh, maybe there is this huge impact of the gut microbiome.
Yeah, it is. It is. I think it's really interesting. I'm just, that's why I'm surprised that, you know, Guberman or someone's not started talking about, you know, after my 90 minutes of putting my arsehole to the sun and then having my first coffee, I
eat some shit.
Okay.
Speaking of, quite a lot of stuff's coming out now, like I feel like someone's going through and directly debunking his claims. So they're not having coffee in the morning, and like pulls up a load of research to be like, there's absolutely no benefit to delaying coffee, like you don't need to do that. Interesting.
Great. It's a great time. I mean, I think it's shady that people are bringing in someone's personal life into their credibility as a scientist. Like, I think that is disgusting. Regardless of what I think about Huberman's content, that I think is bad. And if that was, and I feel a little bit like, what would happen if they were a different gender? Like, what would happen if that was a woman? I feel like there would be more backlash. Like, I don't think people would like it if they were calling out a woman for having an affair on her husband whilst also having a crap podcast. I think people would be like, her personal life's got nothing to do with it. But when it's Huberman, it's like, oh yeah, how can he give out scientific information when he's sleeping with six women? I'm not quite sure how those things are associated or why they're relevant. We can have our own opinions on it, but like, yeah. I'm glad that the scientific rigor side of things is becoming more mainstream, because it's something obviously.
Do you remember when that quite prominent scientist got like completely, I don't know, like lost his whole career overnight because he said something about like women always crying in the lab?
Who was that?
Oh, it was like a really big thing at one point. But he was like, oh, I don't like female PhD students because they always cry or something.
Was and he my supervisor? Because I feel like it's highly likely.
This whole thing on Twitter of like female scientists being like hashtag crying in the lab or something.
What was he? Witless UCL professor Sir Tim Hunt.
Yes.
Yeah, saying that men and women shouldn't work together in the same lab, women cry.
Yeah.
I mean, fair. Although the men in my lab,
you know, you just think, what stupid thing to say.
Yeah. Yeah, when I say fair, I don't really mean like he was fair in saying that. I just mean in my lab, that would be correct. Okay. I mean, eight men not crying and me crying.
Yeah.
Okay, Annie's question. Wondering your thoughts on a client who struggles to honour a craving for chocolate without overeating or having the whole share bar, and is adamant that she has to remove it from her diet to get over it because she has evidence that this worked before when she felt quote-unquote addicted to baguettes, and now she can mindfully eat a piece and move on. My thought process was going one step down, e.g. single bars and not share bars, as opposed to complete removal, and of course continuing to work on all the mindfulness techniques and challenge her beliefs, etc. But curious on your thoughts.
So I mean, my preference would definitely be let's reduce it as opposed to let's eliminate it. But I also wouldn't be against like, okay, let's take it out for 30 days, prove to yourself that you can do it, prove that it doesn't have this like drive over you, and then let's reintroduce it. I also think what's quite interesting, and I don't know if this would be like directly related to chocolate, but more so to kind of taste in general, would be reducing the amount of, say, like really sweet sugary things you have, like chocolate. So for a lot of people, like that probably is the most potently sweet thing that they have. And if you reduce that over a period of time, because she might be needing to have like a whole share bar to kind of get like the taste stimulation of the dopamine hit that she wants, and maybe that started with a small bar, but now to get that same kick she needs to have a bit more and a bit more and a bit more, whereas you can kind of reset that by removing it, and then she might have one bar and be like, god, that was so sweet and so tasty and I don't need any more. because I'm not always used to that like level of taste, and your taste buds reset to that.
Agree, and I agree with your approach, Annie. I agree with what you're saying, and I, but my other sort of side of the coin is this: is okay, you've tried this, you've tried reducing them. She doesn't feel like that's working. She doesn't want to do that. She's really resistant. Then part of me is kind of like, well, then okay, maybe you're the exception. Maybe that is the right thing for you. So why don't we try it in some way, shape, or form where I'm supporting your relationship with food, and then we bring it back in mindfully and we do it like that. Because I think sometimes like we can kind of we know on the whole what's most supportive of relationships with food. On the whole, certain things, unconditional permission to eat food and trolley, etc., etc. Like we know this, right? But we always have to see the person from like where they're at and what they're sharing with us, right? And what you don't ever want to do is be clouded by like that trained incapacity of all of the other people you've worked with, plus all the research and all of the IQ knowledge that you have and all of the extra knowledge that you have because you've learned a lot. You don't want to be clouded by that. And maybe for this person, something like that might feel supportive for her. I wouldn't say, okay, no chocolate for a month. I don't agree with obviously having a hard and fast rule, but like kind of like what you were saying, I'm like maybe just to say, okay, we're not going to have it for a week and then we're going to introduce it mindfully or something like that. So we have some sort of compromise. Maybe that's a good idea. But I would be open, once you've gone through all of these things, maybe open to trying something a little bit different. This is a side note entirely. Something that's come onto Netflix recently, and I saw a stylist article about this, and I'd watched a couple of episodes, was Fat Friends. This, I don't know if you ever watched it when you were a kid. I feel like probably not, but I think I watched it with my mum. It was like a 90s program with loads of actors that kind of became big to noughties actors, and it's all about basically Weight Watchers, but it's not Weight Watchers, and then the narratives around it, around points and bad foods and binge eating, bulimia, like there's loads of topical things in there, and it's such a throwback to diet culture and the really toxic messages that like we our generation were exposed to. Like if I watched that with my mum at 8 or whatever, it's not, this is not a blame thing for her, it's wild to think like those were the messages that we had. Like you obviously see all like the influencers sharing like, no wonder I'm a 90s kid, an 80s baby, and I have all these struggles with my foot. And then they show Spice Girls and stuff. Like, we've all seen them 100 times over. But if anyone is like, oh, I'd like a wee throwback to diet culture, then get that on Netflix. It's terrifying. It's an
But do you
Anna.
think it's like, people put, oh, no wonder I'm like this. Look at all these, like, what was on the front cover of the magazines now. It's like, if someone will do that in 5 years, be like, no wonder I was like this. Look at all these Instagram things that we were like thrown at. And even worse, because like, yeah, you might go and buy a magazine or something, but it's not stuck to your hand 24/7. Like it's completely different. If anything, I think it's worse now. Sure, there's better information, but we are in such an echo chamber of like good information. Like I'm pretty sure that, if I was a 15-year-old girl, my feed wouldn't look very much like it does now, and it would be pretty fucking toxic, right? Just because there's one or two people that are like, well, not one or two, but like there are people that are putting out good messaging. Like, it doesn't mean that it's going to the right people. And I don't know who's putting out. I guess that's the other thing. It's quite an interesting thing. Like, I don't want a 16-year-old girl to follow me, because I don't know that my messaging is right for her, and I would suggest it's probably not, right? Like, it's not targeted at those people. But I don't know who's making content for those people. It's probably 21-year-old girls that are trying to sell Gymshark leggings or whatever, right? But I don't know if there are. And this is the other problem, is that like when you're old enough and educated enough to probably be giving good information to people of that age, you're not relevant to them. Like I could make information for 16-year-old girls, but like they don't fucking care what I think. Like, I'm so, like I'm old, isn't it? Like, but it, so it's quite a hard thing to do. Like, how do you get people? How do you get role models in front of those people who are about of that age or a little bit older, or who they're looking up to, which unfortunately is normally like celebrities or something. Yeah, hard one. Emily's just saying that she's heard me talk about poo transplants before, but I can't remember if you actually put it out on the podcast. I can't remember if we did. I feel like Dr. Mike might have vetoed it. And Karen's just saying, I'm scared to watch Fat Friends again now that I'm older and wiser. Yeah.
But that's a good reason to watch it again now you're older and wiser, to be like, wow, look how far I've come from where I used to be. It is wild when you actually see it, like just the weight stigma of it all. It's just wild. Okay, Libby's question. Hello, lovely people. Sorry in advance. It's a long one. Ready? Ready.
Ready.
Gladiators! Ready! That's all I know. Okay. I have a new client who has been told by a range of dietitians and doctors that she needs to avoid whole grains, rice, nuts, beans, lentils, spices, mushrooms, molds, and fermented foods due to a mix of allergies and digestive and IBS issues. She wanted help with meal planning to support her fat loss goal, but she finds the process of planning so disheartening and avoids doing it, as the long list of things she needs to avoid makes it hard to find meals that she can actually eat with her family. And then she finds herself constantly hungry and overeating, saying she doesn't feel like she can stop. She's absolutely desperate to lose weight and is feeling very disheartened after spending a lot of time and money on dietitians, weight loss tablets, allergy specialists, and hypnotherapists and seeing no results. We've talked about building meals around protein and fiber and focusing on high volume foods to support satiety, making simpler component meals to help avoid the foods she can't have. And I've asked her to explain a bit more about this feeling of not being able to stop eating, and we'll refer out if it sounds like binge eating disorder with loss of control. Overall, I feel a bit overwhelmed and unsure where to go with this lady, and I'm hoping you might have some ideas, please. Nope. It doesn't
It's,
sound like to you that she can put on like the low FODMAP diet and then it just carried on.
yeah, I mean that would be my primary thing. I mean, what's so horrible in this situation is that she has obviously spent a lot of time and effort and money, like especially money, like trying to find an answer to something. And I worry that she's taken a bit from everyone and it has now been left with such a restrictive diet that she's not going to stick to it and she's not sticking to it and then she feels constrained and that I can just like envision it's a horrible situation to be in. Ideally with someone like that, I'd be like, I want to start again. I mean, first of all, I'd be like, who did these tests? And if it wasn't someone I thought was legit or that I thought, you know, like, yeah, if they weren't legit tests, I'd be like, right, let's just start fresh. Like, I want you to forget everything and start again with this plan. But then you know, and it won't be that easy, but trying to get it, because if some of those tests potentially aren't legit and she can eat some of these foods, then reintroducing them might be a whole nother psychological thing of like, well, there's still an element of me that believes I should be cutting out whatever that big long list was. Yeah.
I think it's outside your scope of practice to be meal planning around what sounds to me like a low FODMAP diet. I think a dietitian's probably given her or recommended at some point, let's try a low FODMAP diet to try and manage your IBS, and we'll reintroduce foods. And then for whatever reason that relationship has ended, the reintroduction hasn't happened, and FODMAP diets are outside of the scope of a nutritionist. They're specifically clinical dietitian focus. And meticulous meal planning, sure, given recommendations of like, okay, maybe when you're eating with your kids, you could focus like a meal around this, and that would work to eat with your kids. And other meals, you could have predominantly these types of things. That's fine, but as a right now, I wouldn't say that it's necessarily within your scope to say, okay, these are the foods that you can have. This is what each meal by meal is going to look like. Long term, that's not going to support her, because all it's doing is giving her a specific meal plan with no leeway or flexibility, because you're kind of saying, okay, well, you're telling me you can't eat any of these foods, so this is what we're going with. So there's no scope there for progression, or what we're trying to do with people is help them to figure out how to do this for themselves long term, right? Obviously over time. I agree with what you're saying, like, and I think if that were possible to say like to question some of these things. And it's not about, you've got to be so mindful with these people, because it's not like they're stupid for believing it or they've done something wrong by asking all the people for support. They're doing their best they can and with the knowledge that they have. So you never want to make someone feel silly, not that you ever would Libby. But
Libby's just saying, thank you. Had not considered it could be low FODMAP. When I say meal planning, we were just looking at the latter with the kinds of meals that might fit the list, but definitely not meal by meal. And then okay. She said she's probably going to refer out.
Okay. Okay.
But I guess the hard thing as well is like, okay, if you think it's like binge eating, for sure, refer out. I think before you do, have a chat with her, figure out where she got these tests done, see if she wants it. You can say, look, there's two options here. Do you want me to refer you to this great dietitian I can give you? Or Amelia might know someone. I know someone who would be good for this as well. Or we can start again fresh and let's try this for 30 days. And hey, if it's still not working and you still have these tendencies of overeating, or you're getting side effects of something, then we'll refer out and give her the choice of that.
Yeah, because the thing is too, that'll tell you a lot. If she's willing to go, yeah, let's just scrap it all off, let's try it, then that probably says a lot. But if she's terrified of introducing lentils into her diet, then that is something to refer to. So it will give you a really good indication just having that conversation. And I would also just check in that conversation, like what responses do you have to these foods? Like, is it that you have a severe allergy to something that you know about? Obviously, that's very different from like an intolerance to something and you get bloated, for example. So
don't just be like, ignore that peanut allergy.
Yeah.
Just start fresh with some peanut butter.
I just feel like that's an important disclaimer for, not for Libby necessarily, but for people that are listening to this that are maybe like, oh yeah, those tests are crap. Like some food intolerance tests are generally crap, but you can have genuine allergies. Just a
good disclaimer.
Okay, Libby's question. I have a client who struggles with emotional eating, and when we have made great progress with including things like compassionate questioning and daily self-regulation practices, breathing and meditation, for example, which she's found super helpful. I'm also being very mindful to use phrases that point to common humanity when talking to her. That's great. But she can still struggle with beating herself up over overeating, falling into the fuck it mentality sometimes. A few recent quotes from her are, another disaster day again yesterday, made silly mistakes and beat myself up. Then it all went further downhill, starting again today. And once I am good, then I can be fab. And once I lose it, then I am terrible. I'm sure there's a nursery rhyme like that. I think it's awesome that she has recognised beating herself up didn't help. But I'm wondering if I ought to pick up on her starting again mentality. And if so, how to do this. And what to say to support her with taking imperfect action around the once I'm good bit. Is there anything else I can suggest she tries in these moments when she doesn't seem able to direct herself to other tools, for example, breathing, and to unpick this once I'm good versus once I'm terrible mentality, please?
What do you mean, once I'm good, then I'm fab? Once I'm terrible, then I'm...
I think it's like, it's just the fuck it thing of like, okay, if I only eat vegetables today, I can keep going. But as soon as I eat a cream egg, I'm done for, I think.
I think part of this does come down to just like keeping reiterating stuff. No one's just going to be like, oh, bam, now I don't have any of these tendencies. Now I never have this all or nothing mentality. And even people who don't struggle with that to the same extent as they used to anymore, like, will still have days where they're kind of like, oh, screw it, or, you know. And it's making sure that that then doesn't turn into continued overeating or feeling like you're a failure because of that. I think making it normalized that at some point everyone will still overeat, that's fine, doesn't mean that you've ruined all of the hard work that you've done. It's just that that might have happened every single weekend and now it happens once every 3 months. Great, but that's life, that's normal. Like, I overeat sometimes, Amelia overeats sometimes. Like, it's not, I don't think it's like a, it's that, even that isn't an all or nothing thing, right? It's just the tendency of how often that happens. And I don't know that the, like, I'll start again, like, I'm starting again, is necessarily a bad thing. It might be if it kind of leads into the all or nothing. But if she's kind of a bit like, okay, from tomorrow, making a plan, getting like back on track. And I know some people don't like that, but it's more, sometimes I think we can be a little bit too like pernickety with the wording. Because it gets quite hard to even explain what you mean when you're like, well, there is no track, it's just life, and you're not starting again, but why don't we start fresh? But we're not starting because there's no end point or start point. Like, I think if she's like, yeah, I'm starting again tomorrow, but that's not a negative thing for her, I wouldn't worry about it. You could, you know, if it keeps coming up, you might ask about it, but that wouldn't be a big like red flag to me.
It'd be more a red flag to me, but again, that's probably reflective of, you know, our client base and people that we predominantly speak to. I think on that, like, questioning, like, why do you think, like, is the nutrition working on 24-hour clock? It's like, oh, I go to bed and then I start again tomorrow. Like, what is it so significant? And having the conversation around this in your own way of, like, what's significant about going to sleep and then waking up again the next day? Like, it's still your body, and your body has not switched on or switched off or changed overnight. I wonder if, rather than waiting until the next, you know, clock time to quote unquote start again, you could say, okay, I overeat at lunch, for example. Okay, I can start again at my next meal. Like, why? And even challenging her to sort of take that approach the next time, or one time she overeats this week, you know, I would love it if, rather than you wait till the next day to quote unquote start again, you challenge yourself to bring that time forward and not work off the clock, but just work off the fact that your body is always on, it's always working on a 24-hour period, whatever. So let's try and bring that forward and go to the next meal, because that's effectively, that's like flexible dietary restraint, right? Of like, okay, I ate more at brunch, so I'm going to eat a salad for dinner, as an example of that, right? If someone's managing their calorie intake, that's a sign of a really good relationship with food, rather than going, okay, I ate more at lunch or brunch, and I ate more for the whole day because it was the fucking mentality. So
yeah, but don't you think it's interesting that, like, you can see that as like a really just sensible way to manage your you know, oh, I had brunch and I ate a bit more than I normally would, so I'll just have a smaller dinner, fine. But you could also say that as, I ate brunch, so all I'm gonna have for dinner is a salad.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and it's the same, it comes back to like intent of, okay, you having that because it's sensible and you don't mind, and hey, you really enjoyed your brunch, but you don't need as many calories at dinner now. Or are you doing it because you're like, yeah, there's just a negative intent behind it, and you're restraining yourself and you don't deserve to have dinner, or you know, I can't possibly go over my calories today even though I'm hungry. And this is why it's so important to like get to know your clients and ask those questions, or get them to kind of ask those questions of themselves, like, what's the intent behind that action?
And I think I agree. I think maybe helping her to reframe like what nourishing looks like and what good looks like, and quote unquote good, like, as much as you're moving away from good or bad, like, maybe a first step is good being not your calorie intake, but how many nutrients you got in that day. I don't mean quantifying them, but what variety of nutrients did you get? How did you gift your body with nourishment that day? And so if she eats 4 cream eggs for lunch, as an example, I just keep thinking about cream eggs because they're in a box downstairs. If she ate cream eggs for lunch, okay, fine, that's not an issue at all. How are you going to gift your body later? How are you going to re-nourish by having like lots of different vegetables for dinner, or whole grains or fiber, whatever it is, and kind of trying to reframe that. And then once you're in that state, then trying to remove like that good or bad feeling and just focus it on the nourishment part.
Trying to work out if this makes sense in my head, but I was listening to something today and it was about like the different ways that someone can be rich, and that, like, you know, you can be a millionaire, but if your family don't talk to you because you just spent all your time building your business and now you don't have any friends, like, you're not rich, right? You've got a lot of money, but you're not rich. Or you, I don't know, sold your company for millions, but now you have such poor health because you overworked and you never went to the gym, you never looked after yourself and you never slept and blah, blah, blah. It's like, you're not rich, right? You need the balance. Now, what was I going to make that point to? I kind of think it's similar with this. It's like, you've got to think about how rich your day was. Well, that brunch might have made your day more rich because maybe you ate a few more calories, or you spent a bit more money, or like however you want to gauge it, but you spent time with your friends and family, and like that might be an important element of health, and you enjoyed that meal and you were sociable and you took some time off. It's like all the things that come with it, as opposed to just, well, I went over my calorie target, or I didn't hit my protein target, or however you might be framing it. I guess it's the bigger context of it.
Yeah, I like that. I like it. Okay, that's all the questions.
Okay, Libby's just saying, thank you. I did say about going to a dietitian that I trust, but she refused and got really upset. I think she's scared to spend more money and get hopeful. Also, sorry for such a long message, as I can tell they are pain to read. Not at
No,
all.
they're not a pain to read. I just struggle at this time of night to read things in general. They're not a pain to read.
And I'm
Stop
dyslexic.
apologizing.
So that's why I can't read. But no, great, great question. And I totally get that if someone's in that position. I remember getting like really, and I knew I was doing it, but I'd get really defensive if someone was like, do you want to see my physio about your back? Really help me. I'd be like, no. But then in my head, I'd be like, okay, no, thank you. I've seen many physio. Thank you. But it's like, no, I've already spent thousands of pounds on this. Like, I don't want to see somebody else. So yeah, I understand that.
Okay, thanks everyone.
Okay, thanks everyone. Bye.